Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello and welcome to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and it's the sixth and final episode of our big conversation series from Unbelievable on Judaism and Christianity today, brought to you in partnership with the John Templeton Foundation, and a really interesting and lively interaction for you coming up. We'd love to know, by the way, what you think of today's show. With each of our big conversations, we've been putting out a survey link alongside the show. Do let us know what you think. Multi-choice survey, really quick and simple to take part. We'd really value you doing that if you've a moment. So once you've had a listen to the show, do click on the link for the survey. And of course, if you want more from Unbelievable and the big conversation, including our newsletter, further resources and more besides, do go to thebigconversation.show. So without further ado, welcome to this week's program. Well, today we're asking, how do we recover the Jewishness of Jesus? Jesus was a Jew, but has modern Christianity become divorced from its Jewish roots? And can we recover the distinctly Jewish teachings of Jesus the Rabbi? And how should we understand the shared story and differences between these two great religious traditions? Giles Fraser is rector of St Mary's Newington, a well-known UK journalist and broadcaster, as well as a priest. His recent book, Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, tells the story of the personal crisis that followed his resignation from St Paul's Cathedral and the healing journey of reconnecting with his Jewish roots. Amy Jill Levine, or AJ, as she's usually known, is University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. Now, AJ is a Jew, but who has spent most of her academic life engaged in the study of Jesus and the Gospels, seeking to recover the Jewishness of Jesus. Really looking forward to this conversation, AJ and Giles, on the commonalities and distinctives between Judaism and Christianity, and sort of exploring both your stories in the process as well, because I sort of think that both of you are interesting personal intersections between Christianity and Judaism. So welcome along to the show, both. We'll start with you, AJ. Tell us a little bit about growing up and what it was like to essentially, I suppose, grow up as a Jew in a distinctly Christian community, as far as I'm aware.
Oh, not only distinctly Christian, but distinctly Roman Catholic. I grew up in New England, in Massachusetts, in a neighborhood that was almost entirely Portuguese Roman Catholic. So I grew up with Our Lady of Fatima. I used to go to Mass with my friends because it got me out of Sunday school. And when I was a little child, I liked going to Mass. The services were shorter than they were in the synagogue. But other than that, it was pretty much the same thing. It was a bunch of guys in robes speaking in a language I didn't understand. And there was a lot of sitting up and sitting down. And the major difference was that you got fed during the Mass, but you got fed after Sunday school, right? So my parents told me that Christianity, which for them meant Catholicism, was very, very much like Judaism. We worshiped the same God, the one who created heaven and earth. We prayed the same prayers, most notably the Psalms. We take authority from the same books, whether it's Genesis or Isaiah or the book of Esther. So we're related. So my initial sense of the church was it was like the synagogue we did not go to, because in the town next door, there were three synagogues, and there's the one we went to. And there's the one my Uncle Arnold went to that my father would never set foot in because he didn't like the rabbi. And then there was, and it was all part of the same thing. And we all went to public school. So religious education class was after school. And we'd get on the bus that took us to school in the morning, to first grade, to second grade. And we talk about what we learned in religious education class. I in the next town in Hebrew school and they at catechism. And every once in a while we had, you have Moses? We have Moses. You have David? We have David. And then my Christian friends had a bunch of other people. And I'd go home and ask my, like, who's this Jesus guy? And who's, everybody was named Mary. All the women were Mary. And my parents would say, oh, they're Jews. And what? Oh, like they're part of the family, but, you know, the family we don't talk to. So my initial sense of Christianity, and it's still my sense of Christianity, it's a relative, and there are some problems as we've aged in the branches, those family have moved in different directions. And then a little kid said to me on the bus when I was seven, you killed our Lord. And that created some other questions that were not quite so friendly. So not only, as you mentioned, have I dedicated my entire academic career to looking at Jesus and the Gospels to recover the Jewishness, I've also dedicated it to help Christians read their Gospels and understand their Lord without having to import anti-Jewish stereotypes. I think Jesus looks fabulous. I think he's terrific. I would have a glass of wine with him, because he'd pay, right, with no problem whatsoever. I don't think you need to make Judaism look bad in order to make Jesus look good. And it bothers me that so often that happens in Christian preaching and teaching.
Mm. Wow. You're getting an applause there from Giles Fraser.
Quite right. Absolutely.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation immensely, because I think there'll be a lot of interesting agreement, maybe some disagreement as well as we go along. We'll see. Tell us a bit about your story then, Giles. Maybe start with the book. You call it a ghost story. Why is it a ghost story?
Well, it's a ghost story because it's 10 years ago this October that I resigned from St. Paul's Cathedral. The Occupy movement came, and there was all of that. And for half a millisecond, it was front page news in this country. And people may remember it. But actually, the story is really about what happened next. And at a sort of very low point, me not knowing quite what I wanted to do with my life, not really having a plan, I was encouraged to go and apply for a job in Liverpool, which was to be the Dean of the Cathedral in Liverpool. So I got a train up there. I always get to places ridiculously early, Justin. And I got to Liverpool like 3 hours early or something, sat outside the station, drank coffee, smoked lots of cigarettes. And I think, and then this sort of strange thought wafted across. I thought, I know nobody here. What am I doing in Liverpool? It feels like a sort of, you know, exile, you know. And that's I just don't know anybody there. And then this thought came, actually, I have one very tenuous connection, which is that a distant relative of mine used to run the synagogue for 40 years in Toxteth. So I got a cab and I went up there and I knocked on the door of this synagogue. It was all locked up and there was a caretaker. It was so fortuitous. And the caretaker showed me in, showed me around this extraordinary synagogue built by Christian church builders. So it felt strangely familiar. Quite Puginesque. And then there on the wall is this huge oil painting of Reverend Samuel Friedeberg, who was my great-grandfather's brother. And I looked at this painting and I lost it. I absolutely lost it. I sort of broke down at the side of the road and I cried and cried and cried. I come from on my father's side a very, very long line. I mean, we came to this country in the sort of 1820s. One of the earliest Jewish families in this country, 17, and throughout that time, they sort of increasingly sort of lost their Jewishness, I guess. They sort of like changed their name, they merged, they tried to fit in, dealing with anti-Semitism here. And when the war started, my father, who was a little boy in Golders Green, was taken out of London because it was so dangerous because the Nazis were dropping bombs on Golders Green, and went out to a small country prep school in Biddeford in Devon, and they had little blue crosses on their caps, and it was all he knew. Christianity ended up being all he knew, and that's how I grew up. But this experience of seeing this distant relative really awoke something in me that I hadn't properly dealt with, which is something about my past, something about where I came from. And so I live in a household, my father's Jewish, my wife is Israeli, my two boys are Jewish. We speak Hebrew at home, me quite badly. My five-year-old thinks my Hebrew, if you ask my five-year-old what my Hebrew is like, he'll say, your Hebrew's rubbish, Dad. So he's bilingual, but my Hebrew is rubbish. But anyway, that's what we try and sort of live this life where we model a creative relationship between Christianity and Judaism. We live next door to the church. I'm the priest, and yet when we're in the house, we speak Hebrew and do Jewish festivals. So there's all of that. So I live that tension, most of the time it's wonderful. It's absolutely creative, and I love what AJ said. You know, it's fantastic. There are so many things that you get to learn, so much creative. And there are times when it's painful. There are times when it's really difficult and painful. Yeah. And that's what we live in. It's an extraordinary and wonderful thing, actually.
It's a super book. I really enjoyed reading it. AJ's had the opportunity to read it as well. And it is part memoir, family history, theological reflection, obviously going into some detail as well on that whole situation of 10 years ago, the Occupy at St. Paul's and your own resignation. We might get to some of that as well in the course of the show. What was your response to reading the book, AJ?
I think Giles nailed it when he talked about it as a ghost story. There's a past that haunts, and sometimes ghosts are friendly and sometimes ghosts are things you just have to deal with. So I think that's the right genre, not in the sense of scary, but this is part of my past and how do I acknowledge it? And what does it mean for me today? And that was the part that, besides the history, which I really liked because I'm an historian, but that stuff was familiar. Having a memoir attached to that and showing how this, not only Giles' personal history, but the history of Judaism and Christianity impacts an individual today, I thought was extremely helpful because it shows how relevant the past is once we acknowledge it, and how difficult it is if we don't acknowledge it and don't wrestle with it.
I mean, one of the interesting things about all this, of course, is that, Giles, had your mother been Jewish, you would have been Jewish, ethnically, as it were. But it was by dint of the fact your father was Jewish that you are not yourself Jewish. I mean, AJ, maybe you could explain where that tradition comes from, which in some ways is so different to the usual sort of way things work in the world, isn't it? That things descend on the father's side rather than the mother's side.
Well, at the time of Jesus, it actually did descend on the father's side. That was the dominant view. And it shifts sometime in the second century, right after the Bar Kokhba revolt. And although the reasons are not clear, a number of them have been given. The one that appeals to me the most, and this is a personal judgment rather than an historical judgment, is in a time of war, there is rape. And what do you do with the children? So if you assure that there's a maternal line rather than a paternal line, then the children and consequently their mothers do not find themselves exiled from the community. And then the horrible things that happen, the trauma is continued. So there are a number of reasons for this. But in any case, in the second century, it shifts over to the maternal line. And then because Jews have no head Jew to tell us what to do. And if we did, we wouldn't listen anyway. So we have these different movements in Judaism, as you have different movements in Christianity. So you have Anglicans, not all of whom obey the Archbishop of Canterbury, right? And then you have the Episcopal version and various other versions of whatever that communion is. They're off doing their own thing. So in the Reform movement, and I don't know if this is a problem where you are, but here in the States, people keep saying Reformed Judaism. It's a Reformed, that's Presbyterians. So it's a Reform movement. And they say, if either parent is Jewish, as long as the child is raised in a Jewish household. So now we have these big questions about who counts as a Jew and who doesn't count as a Jew. The lovely recollection of Brother Daniel in the book, who's raised as a Jew during the Shoah, during the Holocaust, converts to Catholicism, and then wants to enter the land of Israel under what's called the law of return, which is if you're a Jew, you can get citizenship, and then they have to take this to the courts to decide, well, this guy's clearly a Jew because his mom is a Jew, but he's also a Catholic priest, in or out. split vote. Mm. And he gets in not because he's Jewish, but because they honored him and requested and accepted his request. So Jews are still debating this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
and the way you end your book, Giles, is actually sort of asking the question, are my children Jewish or Christian? And what I mean, what's your answer to that ultimately?
Well, so the book ends with me baptizing Jonah, my youngest, in the River Jordan, at the place where by reputation Jesus himself was baptized, by tradition. And the interesting thing about it is that the people who gathered there, I was out in Tel Aviv learning Hebrew, doing Ulpan, and the only people we could collect together for that baptism were my Jewish family. So we were there with a Jewish family. They'd never seen a baptism before. They had no idea what this was all about. It's also the place that, actually, interestingly, that the people of Israel first, and this is again by tradition, the people of Israel first enter into the Promised Land. That's the same. That's the same place. So we sort of gathered there, and it's an extraordinary place. So this is a place, in geographical terms, one of the lowest places in the earth. It's a fault line in terms of geography. It's a fault line in terms of politics. You know, so you're on the border between Jordan and Israel, and it used to be a minefield. It's only just been cleared. So the idea that, you know, that there are splits that run through us, and in a way, this the book is about the history of the sort of divorce, the split between Jesus' Jewish following, which became Christianity, and Judaism. And it's a very painful one, and it runs through me, and I suspect it'll also run in some way through my children. I hate the idea that I bequeath to them some split, but that's the reality. But you can see it as a split. You can see it or you can also see it as a really important way of reclaiming, just as AJ has done so importantly in her work, reclaiming a richer, deeper sense of the reality of Jesus and his mission and ministry. So I inhabit this division. Yeah, I mean, yeah. But at times it's not a division.
Well, let's talk about that work, AJ. Just give us a sense of what are some of the key missteps, you think, or mistakes that Christians have often made about Jesus. I mean, where do you begin?
Oh, dear Lord, how much time do we have?
I mean, maybe start with Jesus, the rabbi. I mean, how do you conceive of Jesus? I mean, when you strip away the halo and the, you know, golden hair and blue eyes, what sort of a rabbi was Jesus, as far as we can tell from the historical record?
Yes, well, he's not a rabbi as we think about rabbis from rabbinic literature.
Correct.
Any more than Paul would be a church father as we think about the church fathers from the ante and post-Nicene fathers. Rabbi is just an honorific. It's kind of like, sir, it's my master, my great ones. It's like, sir. Mm-hmm. He's a teacher. He is a lay teacher. He tends not to cite scripture very much. And I think when scripture does get cited, I think that's the gospel writer coming in and filling in the gaps. I think he has an enormous amount of lay wisdom. I think he's influenced strongly by the prophetic tradition. He would have heard scripture in synagogue. I mean, that's what you hear when you grow up. And since he's not distracted by the internet or the local lending library, because there is none in Nazareth, scripture is his base text. I think personally, he had an experience of God. Today we might call those a born-again experience or religious awakening or the bolt from the blue. And it was probably at his baptism that something struck him, that he was commissioned to prepare his people for the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. Okay, that's fine. Where Christians get it wrong? Oh, well, they think that Jews are all struggling to follow every single jot and tittle of the law, and if they don't, God's going to snap them with a lightning bolt or condemn them to hell, which makes all Jews either, you know, sanctimonious or neurotic. And Jesus comes along and says, don't worry, be happy. When he doesn't, he actually makes the law more rigorous, right? The law says, don't murder. He says, don't be angry. That's harder. The law says, don't commit adultery. He says, don't think about it. That's harder. That integration of the internal and the external. A number of Christians, think that Jesus came to do away with purity laws. Quite to the contrary, what he does is restore people to states of ritual purity. So that when people who are in states of impurity, like a hemorrhaging woman, it's probably a vaginal or uterine hemorrhage. Now, I know people might be listening to this over dinner and they don't want to hear such things, but, you know, it's in the Bible. There's no law saying, you know, lady, you have to be locked up in some back shed. There's no law against touching somebody with leprosy. So what he's doing is he's restoring people to states of ritual purity. When he debates with fellow Jews about the law, like can you pluck grain on the Sabbath, which in fact he's not doing, his disciples are doing it. That's a debate at the time. And Joss points this out in the book. You know, the law says honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. And I'm just paraphrasing here. You know, one Jew looks at another and says what constitutes work. And now you have two synagogues, because we're still debating that. So he debates with fellow Jews about how to follow the law, but that doesn't take him away from the law. You don't debate something in which you have no investment.
Correct.
A number of my Christian friends think that Jesus invented feminism and that first century Jewish women were oppressed and repressed and depressed and suppressed by this horrible patriarchal androcentric tradition. And Jesus comes along and says, oh, no, everybody's equal. No, to the contrary. If he did, then 6 out of the 12 apostles would have been women, right? And the mom would have gotten some higher role. He's a first century patriarchal Jew who has women followers, as did Pharisees, as did John the Baptist, as did others.
Justin, can I just put it this way?
Yeah, go ahead,
Charles. Jesus wasn't a Christian. This is the key mistake, is that Christians think Jesus was a Christian. And that Christianity is weird as a religion insofar as the person who, as it were, founded it wasn't a member of the religion that he actually founded. Now, this is a very weird business about Christianity, and it distorts people's thinking. Jesus never heard the word Christian. That wasn't in his mindset, okay?
Giles, can I ask a question about that? Because I like your point, but I want you to develop it just a little bit more.
Yes.
So, and I think you're right. So when you say that people think Jesus is a Christian and he's not, what's the connotation of Christian that they're uploading to what Jesus is?
Yeah, well, it's that. So that they are projecting back onto him a sort of post-Nicene or post-Augustinian or the 2,000 years of sort of what has come to be understood as Christianity, but particularly post, you know, the sort of stuff that Paul does with Christianity. Now, I just don't think that's a part of... Jesus was a temple-going Jew who, although he had arguments with the temple and, you know, Jews having arguments with Jews, by the way, is not an unknown thing. He wasn't unique in having arguments with the temple authorities. I mean, I have to say, the Qumran lot, probably even more so in terms of their arguments with the temple authorities. But we so readily project back. I mean, we've got used to the idea. It's not a controversial thing to now say, obviously, Jesus wasn't blonde hair and blue eyed. So lots of people have got that far. Very, very good. That's great. But now let's keep on going with where that goes and say, actually, Jesus didn't have this sort of fully formed Christian philosophy. Jesus references. This is what I'd say, and I'd like to hear what AJ says about this. We call it the New Testament. I mean, we're used to knowing that we shouldn't really call the Old Testament the Old Testament, the sort of supersessionism. I call it the Hebrew Scriptures. But the New Testament is, there's not that much new in the New Testament. Okay, this is a thing that actually so much of the New Testament is drawn from the book of Isaiah or from the Hebrew Scriptures. Doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense as a book without being understood in terms of the Hebrew Scriptures. So there's not much new in the New Testament, and that's what Christians really have to understand.
So, AJ, did Jesus do anything, quote-unquote, new then? Or do you think he was just another Jewish teacher doing his thing? And was it Paul or someone else that kind of suddenly it took off in a different way? Why did the Christian Revolution take place if he was, in a sense, so typical of other Jewish people at the time?
Well, part of it is packaging. You can have Jews who were known as healers, and there were other charismatic healers or exorcists at the time. And I think Jesus was a healer and an exorcist. You can have other people who were teachers, and they're charismatic. You have people who convince others to leave their mothers and fathers and spouses and children and follow him. And that becomes a sectarian movement. When you put it all together, and then you have a group of his followers who are convinced that he is Lord and Savior, and therefore convinced because they experienced him as having risen from the dead, that gives you something that's quite distinct. He does say some things that I can't track elsewhere. He's the only person I know who comes out and says you have to love your enemies, which is really hard. Jewish law says you can't mistreat them. If you're hungry, you've got to feed them, right? If they're lying in a ditch, you've got to take care of them. But nothing says you have to love them. Jesus just ups the ante a little bit or a lot. Jesus talks about making a new covenant in his blood. I don't know anybody else who's doing that. That's interesting. So he has his own distinctive parts, and a great much of his teaching when it comes to things like ethics, morality, storytelling, that's part of the culture. I also would not dismiss charisma. Certain people have it and certain people don't. And you can just see this if you watch theater, right? You get the actor who was hired to play the part and it's fabulous. You get the understudy and the evening was a disaster. Same words, different presentation. So I won't leave that out. I want to take issue with something that Giles said, right? Because I'm an American and crude. And yeah. You know, I actually think that the term Old Testament should be recuperated. In the same way that we recuperate words like queer, which is a perfectly normal term to use these days, and it can be quite complimentary. Why? Well, first of all, at last time I checked, which was last night when I was finishing your book, you're still an Anglican. And in your Old Testament, you have Greek stuff. So if you talk about the Hebrew Bible, you're actually chopping off part of your canon. Hebrew Bible is a Protestant term. You're not a Protestant. You're part of the Catholic community, right? So you get books like Judith and Susanna. You got the books of the Maccabees. The holiday of Hanukkah, you got the books of the Maccabees. It's a fair trade. So I don't like Old Testament, Hebrew Bible. And I also don't like it because it suggests that Jews and Christians are reading the same canon, and we are not. Because the story that the Old Testament tells, starting with Genesis and ending with Malachi, the prophet Malachi, is a promise model. Everything drives toward Jesus. And that's how his early followers read the text. And he may have read it the same way if he thought he was commissioned in that sense. So it's a promise model. And then you get the fulfillment model. And you get it really coolly to go back to that baptism scene. You have, by the way, a lovely picture of you and your child in the river. That's how the book ends. I think it was great before the back matter. So what happens? Malachi predicts right at the end of Malachi, the end of the Old Testament, the coming of Elijah to announce the Messianic age. And then the Gospel of Mark, which is probably the first gospel that we have, begins with John the Baptist in the role of Elijah, announcing not the Messianic age, but the Messiah, Jesus. So it's a promise fulfillment model. So I'm old. I turned 65 last week. I'm old. Old is fabulous. Old gets you Medicare. It gets you health care in the United States. It gets you discounts at the liquor store.
Hang on a second. You know the problem is not about the old bit. The problem is the old and the new juxtaposition. It implies this form of supersessionism, which that Christianity is a sort of upgrade of Judaism. And this is the problem. Seeing it as a sort of like, you know, well, that's how it used to be, but now it's this. Okay. And that's what's implied by that. And that's bothersome.
Yeah, I'd rather shift it. It's not an upgrade of Judaism. It's an upgrade of the Old Testament. And that's correct in the same way that rabbinic literature is an upgrade of the Old Testament. Because both Judaism and Christianity, or is an upgrade of the Tanakh, right? The Jewish Bible. Because what Christianity is commentary on. And nobody's practicing the type of Judaism that Jesus was practicing, Second Temple Judaism. So you've got rabbinic commentary over here saying, here's how we understand Deuteronomy, or here's how we understand Leviticus. And you've got the New Testament over here saying, here's how we understand Deuteronomy, and here's how we understand Leviticus. It's an older text for both of us. I just want old to be respected, and that's why I want to recuperate that term. Because I can't find anything in the default that works.
We'll come back to this in just a moment, folks. So we're just going to take a quick break. Fascinating stuff. And I do want to talk about the new and the old split, because there is a sense in which, you know, it's hard to avoid Jesus doing something new when he takes the Passover meal, the Seder meal, and he does something new with it, you know, at the, you know, in the Eucharist. So we'll talk about these issues, and we'll talk about maybe a bit about Paul as well, and St. Paul's, the cathedral as well, in the course of the rest of the conversation. My guests on The Big Conversation today, talking about Judaism and Christianity, are Giles Fraser and Amy Jill Levine, or AJ as she's known, and we'll be back very shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And just a reminder that today's show on the Jewishness of Jesus is one we'd like to hear your thoughts about as well. There is a simple multi-choice survey in the info with today's show. Why not fill it out? Let us know what you think. And if you want more from The Big Conversation, including bonus content, then do sign up there as well at thebigconversation.show. Well, today we're asking, how do we recover the Jewishness of Jesus? Great to have on the show today Giles Fraser, whose new book Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, tells his own story of the healing journey he went on reconnecting with his Jewish roots. AJ Levine is University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University, and a Jew who has spent her academic life really engaged in the study of Jesus and the Gospels. Loving the conversation so far, folks, but... you know, your insistence, Giles, that the New Testament and Christianity in that sense is not an upgrade on Judaism. I mean, a lot of people will think, well, isn't that the whole point, that Jesus came to do something quite radically new, taking a tradition like the Passover feast and saying, I am now that lamb. I am the summation of all of this. And there's something rather new about that. So is it any surprise that people think about this as a new thing? Albeit that obviously in those first years, the movement was still very much part and parcel of Judaism. It was still temple going Jews who believed that the Messiah had come. But that in itself is a novel claim, arguably, isn't it?
I mean, you're right, obviously. I mean, but one of the things that AJ said earlier is that if you go back to the first century, there isn't a head Jew, okay, that gets to define what Jewishness is. Okay, if you go back to this period, there's all sorts of different expressions of Judaism, all of which are arguing with each other, all of which are disagreeing. Now, Christianity is one of those. They're all doing something new. So to that extent, quite right, that there is something new. But the way in which they're doing something new is within the... recognizably within the sort of like the parameters, the literature of, and we've already discussed this and disagreed with it, the Hebrew scriptures. Okay, so let's just forgive me that, AJ, for now, but we'll so or what people might like to say, the Old Testament. You know, there is no way of understanding the whole sort of messianic movement which Jesus taps into without understanding the way in which that grows out of, you know, the kings and David and then through Isaiah and all the different sorts of tributaries that it doesn't make any sense without that. So this is what I mean by there isn't very much new about the New Testament. It's the idea that there's something like this is some sparklingly different. It isn't. I mean, obviously there are differences but they're differences that are well within, put it this way, well within the bandwidth of legit, I would say, within, in the first century, legitimately Jewish experience. You know, people are disagreeing about a whole range of things, and Christianity is one of them. Christianity begins to become very separate from, Jewish Jesus following becomes very separate from other Jews, when it starts to see itself almost increasingly exclusively as a mission to the Gentiles. And that, you know, it becomes a sort of international phenomena rather than a phenomena rooted in a particular sort of place. And we've learned in the last few years to start talking about somewheres and anywheres. And it's a little bit like that. There is something about that the Jewish experience, which is rooted in place, and there's something about the Christian experience which becomes, as it were, international. And that's when they start getting very different sorts of things. One of the really interesting things is, you know, when Paul starts to think about the Christian experience being there for the Gentiles, he doesn't deny that it is also there for Jews. But increasingly over the first few centuries, Jewish Jesus followers get written out of the script. They get squeezed from both sides. They get squeezed from the emerging synagogue, and they get squeezed from the emerging church. And ultimately, this sort of gets written out of the story. Christianity defines itself as not Jewish. Judaism defines itself as not Christian in the first few centuries. And those people who still go to synagogue and think Jesus is the Messiah, they end up being entirely stranded, ideologically written out of the script.
What's your thoughts on that analysis, AJ?
I think that was spot on, particularly the conclusion. Paul himself is not a Christian, and Paul doesn't use the term either. So if you have to figure out what's new with Paul, Paul is a Jew who believes that the Messianic Age has broken in with the death and resurrection of Jesus. Okay, so you're a Jew, and the Messianic Age is here. Now, you might have thought, oh, everybody comes back from the dead, because that was on the books. Or all the exiles, all the Jews who had been dispersed throughout the Roman Empire, and places south and west and east, they would all come back to the land of Israel, called the ingathering of the exiles, including the 10 lost tribes, who, as far as I know, are not the British and have not yet returned. Okay. There is no peace on earth. There's no final judgment. But the Messianic Age is here. So how do you know, and what do you do? Well, one of the signs of the Messianic Age, and you can see this in Isaiah, that sounds so much better. You can see it in Isaiah, or you can see it in Zechariah, is that the idea that the Gentile nations will turn from their pagan gods, called idolatry, to worship the God of Israel. So Paul, who has his own experience, it's not a conversion experience, it's not like he went from being a Jew to being a Christian, but he has this, I'm going from being a persecutor of this movement into the diaspora to its major PR guy, says, I am commissioned to bring this good news, which is what gospel means, to the Gentile world, to the pagan world. And now he's got to explain to pagans how this Jewish Messiah, who dies on a cross in the land of Israel, and whose book is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that's what they're supposed to follow. And the marketing was brilliant. And what he was able to do is tell these Gentiles, you are now equal with Jews in terms of, you don't have to be like a visitor in the synagogue. You're equal to anybody else who's there. And you are part of the covenant with Israel. And because he's a good Jew who knows morality, if you're hungry, we will feed you. And if you are sick, we will nurse you. And if you have no family, we will be your family. And when you die, we will bury you and take care of you. And Gentiles turned to this because it spoke to them in a way that the various pagan cults were not doing. Plus, it was free. This was the best market offer in town. You didn't have to pay for a sacrifice. You got dinner. They fed you. What could be better?
But you cast this as one of the problems, in a sense, Giles. It's both a blessing and a curse. The universality of Christianity also means that it becomes a sort of something that begins once, I suppose, Rome gets involved, to be imposed upon people. And is that your problem with the way that it was ultimately divorced from its Jewish roots?
Well, I've got lots of problems, but this is one of them. One of the things that that the Stalinists accused Jews of being was rootless cosmopolitans. That's a thing that's regularly accused. That's not Jews. That's Christians who are rootless cosmopolitans. Fundamentally, Christianity, Judaism is a religion that has a rootedness in place. Christianity is rootless. It has no ultimate loyalty to place. Now I have a I now. There are good things and bad things about rootedness in place, and there are good things and bad things about, as it were, your internationalism. The bad thing about Christian internationalism is it can very easily sit alongside the desire for empire. So the idea of converting the world and empire, and the British Empire, those two things were were they cooperated with each other. So that's part of the problem. I love you. I love everybody. You will all think exactly as I do. Now, that's a dangerous part of Christianity. You know, I embrace you all, but what I'm really asking you to do is to think like me. Okay, now I take you seriously. I want you to believe what I do, but there is a dangerous quality to that. On the flip side, there is a different sort of dangerous quality. It's not as dangerous, actually, as Christianity, but there's a sort of like you can get with Judaism. You can get a sort of like this is us. This is what we think. We don't want to convert you. We're not that bothered about what you think. That's not totally true, because it shouldn't be true, because one of the things that's there from Abraham through Isaiah and so forth is that the Jewish people who are chosen by God are also a blessing to the Gentiles, to the nations, to all of us. And so, you know, there is an obligation on Jews to explain and to model how they are also a blessing to the world. But nonetheless, there is a very, very different sort of experience. And I think there's good and bad in both, actually. I think it's a complicated thing. But that's where I think that's one of the big tensions.
Think about it. And this goes back to another error that some of my friends make. So I'm presuming that most of your listeners have heard of the parable of the Good Samaritan, where this question the lawyer says, who is my neighbor? And my Christian friends go, oh, that's a terrible question, because everybody's your neighbor, right? What? No, your neighbor is your fellow Jew, right? And if you read Leviticus, where it says, love your neighbor as yourself in Leviticus 19, that really does mean fellow Jew. The problem is, if you read on in Leviticus, which Christians tend not to do, because Leviticus doesn't come into the church the same way that Isaiah or the Psalms does, is the same chapter in Leviticus goes on to say, you have to love the stranger who lives, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. In other words, Jews have two categories. You've got a neighbor and you've got strangers, and you have to love them both. And you can see that in Jesus' parable of the final judgment, the sheep and the goats. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Right? What happens in Christianity is the category of stranger drops out. You're either the neighbor, which means you're a fellow Christian, you're a potential neighbor, or you're a heretic or an apostate or an infidel, and therefore we're going to kill you. So it's a question of how do you deal with the other without trying to make the other you? And that's the dangerous side of a universalistic rather than, as Giles correctly noted, an ethnically based religion. You can convert to Judaism if you want, which makes you a member of the Jewish people. But you don't have to. And Jews aren't banging on your door saying, have you met Moses?
No, they're not. I mean, what's your feeling, though? I mean, it is obviously an evangelistic religion, AJ. Do you have a problem with that? I mean, is that a downside of Christianity, or is it just part and parcel of what the religion is, in a sense? You know,
I have so much fun when evangelists come to my door. I just love it. Yeah, do you want to start with the Greek or the Hebrew? I think Christians ought to evangelize because Christians are commanded to do so. The Great Commission in Matthew is go make disciples. Well, you can translate it all to Gentiles and let the Jews off the hook. But that original mission to the Jews never got abrogated, right? That's still there. And while Paul is out dealing with his Gentile audience, Peter takes his role as the apostle to the Jews. So that's still out there. But it's a matter of not should you evangelize. If you want to, by all means, do so. But how do you do it? And how do you do it with respect for your fellow Jew or your fellow Hindu or Muslim or whoever? And you do it not by telling the other person what's wrong with that person's religion. You do it by telling the person what's right with your religion, right? So I say to my students, if you want to evangelize, you first have to know why you are a Christian and why that means something to you. And if the answer is simply because this is how I was raised or because I got social justice, that's not going to carry. Got that anyway.
I mean, to a Jewish person who does convert, say, to Christianity, and then goes on to say, now I feel like I'm a fulfilled Jew, that I do know the Messiah has come. Do you find that patronizing, arrogant, or do you say, well, hey, that's your way of looking at it?
I find it an unfortunate term because it's going to code negatively to most Jews who hear it. And anything mm-hmm. that demeans one particular group or sounds like it demeans a particular group, I don't think is a helpful way of expressing somebody else's religion. So if you say, I had an emptiness and now I feel fulfilled, which is a personal experience which rings true to that individual, that's terrific. That's different from making a universalizing claim that this is the fulfillment of Judaism.
And what's your, because I don't get the sense that you're a great fan of, for instance, Giles, the Messianic Jewish sort of movement as such. You don't particularly have a burden to see Jewish people accept Jesus as the Messiah. Would that be fair to say, Giles?
It'd be correct. I'm very nervous of, and wouldn't myself be any part of a sort of mission to the Jews. You know, I think, by the way, I think the Jewish people have a particular relationship with God, which is there in the Bible, and I think God knows quite. God knows what he's doing with the relationship with the Jewish people, and he doesn't need my help. Okay, so and there is a distinction between the distinction running throughout the Bible between the relationship of God and the Jews and the relationship of God and the Gentiles. I'm a Gentile, but I am very nervous of, but not least, let's just name it. I'm very nervous of the Christian mission to the Jews because of the history of anti-Semitism with which Christianity has been bound up. I mean, just so phenomenally, forced conversions, violence for centuries, okay? And conversion has been a part of this story of anti-Semitism. So I'm sorry, I know, Jewish people have converted to Christianity and that they bring a rich experience of God with them. And I celebrate that. But I will be no part of trying to convert Jews to Christianity.
But there's nothing stopping you from bearing witness, right?
It's not
a conversionary effort. So I tell my students, listen, don't set up a separate mission to Jews. It's just in terms of cost benefit analysis, you can invest your time better elsewhere because most Jews aren't going to pay attention. But if you want a witness to Jews, do so by how you act, right? And if that works, that's terrific. But if you follow your Old Testament or even your New Testament, Jews are still under covenant. That covenant was never abrogated, and if you want to make Jesus the final judge, which is kind of how he functions in the New Testament in certain passages, then that's up to him. And he gets to determine who's saved and who's damned. That's not your job.
AJ, I have enough problem witnessing to the people of South London. Okay, so this is. I'll just chew off as much as I can manage, you know. So I'm not going to go into the whole idea of the conversion of the Jewish people. There's so much rubbish been talked about, you know, when there are those people who believe that only if you convert the Jews to Christianity, only then the Messiah will come again and all of that sort of stuff. I just don't go there. I have enough here in South London to sort out without worrying about that.
Well, it sounds almost, AJ, in this particular conversation, that you're more keen for Giles to wear his faith on his sleeve when it comes to Christianity than always he is.
I'm not keen about conversionary issues, but I am also not keen on telling Christians that they should not bear witness to their faith.
Sure.
Because I don't think you sacrifice the particulars of your own religion on the altar of interfaith sensitivity, which is one of the things I appreciate about Giles' book. He's a Christian. You can tell.
I am.
Absolutely. But in a sense, though, Giles, as a Christian, presumably you do believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the long promised awaited one, the one who fulfills all the hopes and fears of all the years, you know. And in that sense, there is presumably a distinctive here between you and AJ, as much as you agree on a great deal. AJ, how do you respond to that central claim of Christianity that Jesus was the fulfillment of all of that long-awaited Messiah, and indeed his death and resurrection, you know, which obviously, as you say, launched this movement in a very different way to any other Messiah-led movement of the first century?
Right. So my question to my students, and my primary job at Vanderbilt is to teach people who want to be Christian ministers how to read the New Testament, which is a weird job for a Jew in Tennessee. So, you know, I grant that, is to say to them, if you believe all this, what difference does it make in your own life? And if it makes no difference, go, you know, go believe in the giant spaghetti monster or believe in some other God from some other religion, because it doesn't matter. So they've got to figure out what, if Jesus comes back in the body, what does that tell you about your own body? Because he could have come back as Jesus, the friendly ghost. He's in a body he eats. What does that say about your body? If he comes back and there's a sense of something beyond death, well, what does that do when you're counseling somebody who's dying? And what do you say? And how does this impact your belief system? I don't have that belief system, but I know that Paul did. And I know that Matthew did, and I know what I teach in a non-denominational school, so I know what Episcopalians think and what Lutherans think, at least what they're supposed to think. I say, how does this particular worldview then function in your own life, and how does this help you read the text? So I don't have to believe it in order to be sympathetic to it. I'm a teacher. I'm not a practitioner.
And what do you make of that, Giles? I mean, to what extent does the radical claim there of Christianity make a difference? I mean, is this a serious disjunct? You know, I suppose I'm trying to find if there is a kind of, you know, a point at which you I mean, can you just say, well, it's all.
No, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God. So this is the point at which the creator of heaven and earth enters into our lived reality in time and space and makes a difference. Now, Jews aren't going to accept that. Clearly not. But that's the basis of my faith. I just don't think you can understand what that really means in religious terms without understanding the biblical context for that. And the biblical context for that is also fundamentally, as it were, Jewish. So that's what's going on here. But yes, absolutely. I'm quite a straightforward, boring, orthodox Christian insofar as I think that that there is something extraordinary about what happens with the incarnation and that God enters time and space in a unique way to bring a completely different sort of relationship between humanity and God. Cool. So that's a massive big claim.
I wouldn't describe you as boring, though you may be orthodox, Giles. But one of the bits I enjoyed most in the book, actually, was when you talked about St. Paul's. And again, set the scene for those who may be not familiar with this, especially listeners, you know, overseas who watch and listen to Unbelievable. The Occupy movement that took over the area around St. Paul's and why you ultimately led to you feeling as a canon of St. Paul's you had to resign in terms of what happened. And then you make this fascinating connection with the temple in Judaism and the way that there was a sort of purity code, if you like, and that in some ways what happened at St. Paul's was reaching back to that sort of sense of something pure was being defiled by these.
Okay,
dirty,
so
smelly
so much
protesters.
To say here, Justin. So much to say about this, and I'll try and keep this. So let's just do the history bit about me. So for those who don't know, I used to be canon chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral. That's the sort of like, you know, the canon theologian, I guess, there. St. Paul's Cathedral, the mother church of England. You know, it was my dream job, fantastic place to be. Occupy comes 10 years ago. That's the sort of complaint against global capitalism. They park themselves right outside the cathedral. The cathedral ums and ahs about what they want to do for several weeks, and in the end decide they want to evict them. I don't go along with the idea that you should evict peaceful protesters, potentially with violence, in the name of the church. And when the cathedral authorities decide to go ahead with this, I resign. So that's what happens to me. Now, there's lots of very interesting theological things that happen in the course of this. One of the interesting things, St. Paul's itself was, Christopher Wren was fascinated by the Jerusalem temple. There was a model of the Jerusalem temple that had done the rounds a few years before, a sort of European It was a sort of almost a travelling circus, really, of the temple. Great big model. Wren may or may not have been a mason, which are obviously obsessed with the temple and how the temple works. So Wren himself was a really sort of like a student of the Jerusalem temple, or certainly what they thought the temple was then. And St. Paul's is a homage to the Jerusalem temple, put it that way. In the course of one of the things that happens in the course of the Occupy protesters is that an unfortunate situation where it's a woman, elderly woman, goes into the cathedral and is taken short. And I think she had mental health issues, and there was a problem, and she evacuated her bowels in the cathedral. So this is a very interesting, theologically, this becomes for me a very interesting thing. So the question is this a social justice issue? Which you, as it were, clean it up. It's not very nice to clean it up, but you clean it up, you look after the woman, and you see this in social justice terms. Or is this some sense of ritual defilement, okay, that's going on here? Now, this is very, I mean, it may not be all that much of an interest to your listeners, but actually it would have been a real interest, this sort of thing, to people in the first century. This is the sort of thing they would really have been exercised by. The question about the relationship between, as it were, moral defilement and ritual defilement. There's quite a bit of detailed stuff in the book where I try, actually, sort of, in a sense, against my instincts. And my instincts are sort of the moral side, to try and reclaim what a sort of ritual purity might be and why it's important. And that for me, that was the sort of a part of the book that required quite a lot of the gears to go round when I was trying to sort of, as a sort of, you know, lefty liberal priest, to try and reclaim something of this purity stuff, which, you know, part of me has a sort of bit of suspicious of, you know, to actually say, come on, let's try and really think through why this is important. And, you know, I think that's probably some of the theology there is quite, I don't know, it's quite detailed and quite difficult to go through. But that was some of the most important stuff in the book.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that particular chapter yourself, AJ?
There are certain parts of the Jewish tradition in the Second Temple period that Christianity takes and runs with, one of which is the sacrificial system in the temple system. And Judaism, following the destruction of the temple in 70, reboots and says, okay, we lost a temple to the Babylonians back in the 6th century. We've now lost another temple. We've been there, done that. We know how to do this. How do we locate that divine presence in the absence of the temple? And the church went with what eventually became the sacrifice of the Mass, or the idea of the cross as a sacrifice. And then the New Testament is a very, very bloody book. So you get the blood of Jesus all over the place, which when you think of it is kind of weird because crucifixion is not exsanguination, but nevertheless. And what Judaism did is it shifted from place to text. So that for Judaism, the incarnation of God, the word of God taking on flesh, is the Torah scroll. And it's also the tree of life. And it is the presence of the divine brought to the congregation during the worship service, and in effect undressed and read and then redressed and then put back in its nice little house, as you would do with the Eucharist. So, the church takes some of that temple architecture, as we've seen, and some of the temple idea of sacrifice. You can really see this in the Epistle to the Hebrews, which I have to explain to my students, Jews don't read because it's in the New Testament. And Jews say, okay, well, we still know that blood sacrifice is efficacious, but, you know, even in parts of Leviticus, you can have forgiveness of sins with basically it's a vegetarian option. So we no longer have blood sacrifice. What do we do? Well, we have options. We've always had options. So let's run with the options. And what we'll do is we'll marginalize the role of the priest and replace the role of the priest. And this was already happening with the Pharisees. We'll replace the role of the priest as the teacher and the liturgical leader with the role of the synagogue ruler, and then eventually with the role of the rabbi.
I just want to say this is a very interesting business, because this is one of the areas, as a sort of like on the sort of more Catholic spectrum of Christianity. And so, you know, the sacrifice of the Mass is something that I just celebrated Mass like an hour ago. And you know, what happens with Christianity and Judaism, with the destruction of the temple, is that you could say that Christianity maintains more of the sacrificial imagery than Judaism does. Judaism becomes, as it were, a religion of study and the book and all of that sort of stuff and the text. But Christianity, through the Eucharist, through the person of Jesus, retains this sacrificial element. Now, of course, you know, you could say that the temple will one day be, you know, rebuilt and sacrifices will return and Jewish priests will return and so forth, which is obviously a highly political statement as well. But Christianity retains a great deal of that sort of sacrificial imagery that's there within the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures, in a way that the developing rabbinic Judaism doesn't really. Now, that's a very interesting complexity about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism and the Hebrew scriptures.
Yep, I think that's spot on.
We'll come back to this in the final part of today's show. Judaism and Christianity and recovering the Jewishness of Jesus is our topic on The Big Conversation today. I'm Justin Brierley, joined today by Giles Fraser and Amy Jill Levine. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable, the sixth and final episode of our Big Conversation series in partnership with the John Templeton Foundation. Judaism and Christianity, that conversation with Giles Fraser and AJ Levine will be continuing in a moment. Don't forget, you can take part in the survey alongside it. We've been doing this with each of our Big Conversations this year. We'd love to know what you think. So if you've got time, please do fill it out. We really value your thoughts on today's show. You can also, of course, sign up for more from Unbelievable and The Big Conversation at the website, thebigconversation.show. Coming up on next week's show, Jackie Hill Perry, an African-American teacher, poet and Christian hip-hop artist, will be joining me. She's author of the books Gay Girl, Good God and Holier Than Thou, How God's Holiness Helps Us to Trust Him. This will be a replay of a live Facebook and YouTube Q&A that we did with Jackie this past week on Unbelievable. So if you were there, I hope you enjoyed it and maybe got to ask a question. If not, you'll be able to hear it all on next week's edition of the show. And if you want to be alerted to things like, you know, special Q&As, live stream editions of the show, bonus content and all the rest of it, again, good reason to be signed up to the newsletter as well. Also to come tonight on The Profile, you may remember that last week Sohrab Ahmari joined me along with John Vervaeke to discuss wisdom and the meaning crisis. Well, on The Profile tonight, it's just Sohrab Ahmari talking through his new book, The Unbroken Thread, with me in more depth. I think you'll really enjoy that if you enjoyed last week's show. That's on The Profile tonight, or go and download The Profile podcast if you'd like more from the show. And thanks to Ruth LeVay, who got in touch to say thanks for another brilliant and absolutely relevant interview. She was talking about that show with Jackie Hill Perry we did live in this last week. You're glad that someone with Jackie Hill Perry's credibility is speaking out on these issues. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Ruth. There'll be more of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Right now, though, let's jump into the final part of this week's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's final big conversation in our current season. It's been a fascinating discussion on Judaism and Christianity. Just a quick reminder, we've got a survey we'd love you to fill out with your thoughts on today's discussion as well. You can find the link with the info from today's show, and you can sign up to thebigconversation.show for more conversations and bonus content. Giles Fraser and AJ Levine have been my guests on the show today, talking about Judaism and Christianity and recovering the Jewishness of Jesus. I've really, really enjoyed the conversation today. I'll make sure there are links to you both from today's show as well, including the book we've been talking about, Chosen. I want to sort of throw it over to you guys, really, what you want to talk about in this final segment of our time together. I think you have a question for Giles, AJ, around on a practical level.
Not just for Giles, for any Anglican who happens to be listening in. And I hope that your survey is not like Team Giles and Team AJ, and then like the American loses.
Oh, no.
I worry about that. It's like, you know, vote for the Jew.
Vote for her.
What I would really like to see, and I actually gave a sermon on this at the National Cathedral, which is an Episcopal cathedral here in the United States, in March during Lent, because they put me in the pulpit virtually. I would like to see changes in lectionary readings. I think there are too many pairings of Old Testament readings with New Testament readings that have exactly that supersessionist approach, and there's no reason for that. The Anglican Church last year came out with a text called God's Unfailing Word, and it's about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. It's very long. It's very British, which just goes on and on and on. But you can find some really good gems in there. And I think it would be great if that could serve, or at least a shortened version, could serve as a study base for Jews and Christians to start talking to each other. I want all Anglican clergy to learn about Second Temple Judaism so that they do not have to make Judaism look bad in order to make Jesus look good. And to do that, you don't learn from rabbis, because most rabbis know nothing about Second Temple Judaism, because there's no Second Temple Jewish text that has relevance to contemporary Judaism, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. So you need an academic who knows what's being preached on Sunday morning to come in and do that. And I want Jews and Christians to be able to attend each other's worship as guests without being pressured, and knowing what they can and cannot do, or should and should not do, but so that we can better know each other. And one way better to know each other is to know how we worship and what we say. I find, as a Jew going to Christian worship, whether it's an Episcopal church or a Lutheran church or a Methodist church, what a Catholic church, whatever it is, I find that it rings true in so many ways to my own tradition. And I can appreciate it as a guest. But so often what happens is somebody will make a gratuitous anti-Jewish comment, and it ruins the entire service for me.
Correct.
So I want to be safe in Christian worship because I like it, and I learn from it, and I'm often inspired by it, and I don't want to be disrespected at the same time. And I want the same thing to happen in synagogues, because I have heard a number of rabbis gratuitously make anti-Christian comments when they don't have to do it, because rabbis know even less about Christianity, particularly the Orthodox rabbis, than Christian ministers know about Judaism.
What's your thoughts on all of those suggestions, Giles?
I did some teaching about Christianity the other day about Bar-Ilan University at Bar-Ilan University, and I was very surprised about how little that they knew about Christianity. I mean, really, how little they knew about Christianity. AJ is, I'm sorry, this is boring. If you want us to disagree with each other, you're not going to find that, Justin, because AJ is absolutely right. I mean, she's just a font of wisdom about all of this and everything. I just second everything. Listen, so my wife is Israeli. My wife is Jewish, but she's the vicar's wife. So she comes, she doesn't come to church, but occasionally she does. She comes to support me. She usually makes the cake. She makes a damn good cake for after church. But occasionally she'll come to church. She came to church around Easter time, and I get there to read the gospel. I go to the centre of the church, I read the gospel, and I go, they were hiding in the upper room for fear of the Jews. Yeah. Okay, so I'm saying this, and my wife and my two Jewish boys are in there, and I'm thinking to myself, what on earth is going on here? What am I saying? Now, there are modern translations of the New Testament. Bentley Hart's one is an obvious one, where actually this is not, they're not described as Jews in this passage, they're described as Judeans. Now, that's actually an interesting academic argument, which I'd be very interested to know what AJ thinks about. But nonetheless, there are a whole range of subjects. I spent my day today, Justin, listening to a conference that happened a couple of years ago in the Vatican on the subject of the Pharisees, for instance, and what the now, if you ask Christians what the do a sort of like a word association on the Pharisees, they'd give you hypocrites, they'd give you all this sort of stuff. Now, this is extraordinary stuff that we have here, you know, that we have a particular sort of religious experience and a group of religious people who are, I don't think it's too much to say, demonized in our the way we understand things. And we really have to sort of like work out what's going on here. And, you know, is it safe to go if my wife or AJ comes to church and what do we do with those texts which talk about Jews as being hypocrites, which talks about the fear of the Jews, which indeed in Matthew's gospel, you know, blood is upon you and upon your children and all of that sort of stuff. By the way, let's have this nailed in this conversation. The Jews did not crucify Jesus. Okay, that is a Roman instrument of torture, and only Romans could put someone up upon it. Okay, this is what Romans did to keep people in their place. And there is something utterly disgraceful about the way in which this Roman instrument of torture and the death of Jesus has been linked to Jews for centuries. So we have a lot of work to do. And I'm going to say one more thing, Justin. I know you want to come in. One of the problems about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism is about the relationship of Christianity and empire and power. And what's happening in the last 1,500 years is Christianity is getting stripped of its power. Christianity is getting stripped of empire. We're beginning to lose that association with secularization. And I think we have an opportunity for Christians and Jews to talk to each other that's only recently begun because of the way in which Christianity is being stripped of its power. Sorry, that was a little rant. I apologize.
No, a great rant, a really interesting rant. I mean, if I may be the one to try and introduce at least a note of division then, again, what about, though, and I fully accept that there are many things that Christians could do better to not alienate and, frankly, insult their Jewish friends when they come to their churches or worship services. But in the end, isn't ultimately there a natural sense in which a Christian will inevitably think of their faith as a fulfillment of the Jewish scriptures? Just in terms of that Eucharist, which you only recently celebrated, Giles, as I mentioned, it is in a sense, you know, Jesus saying, I am now the true temple, the Lamb, the, you know, all of those things were just pointers ultimately to me coming and fulfilling them all. So there's a degree to which if a Jewish person finds that offensive, that's going to be difficult to avoid ultimately, isn't it, Giles?
Correct. That's true. I mean, the thing is about seeing Jesus as the Messiah, as the fulfillment of God's promise, is as it happens that there are enormous amounts of people, dozens of people in Jewish history who Jews have thought of as being the Messiah. So let's just, I mean, and I spend quite a bit of time in my book looking at a very recent one, which is that the recent Lubavitcher rabbi, Rabbi Schneerson, was seen by a number of his followers to be the Messiah. And this offends many Jews, but it doesn't stop people from thinking that the followers of Rabbi Schneerson were Jews. No one actually goes they weren't Jews. They just think they're a bit weird. They think they're wrong. They get offended by them. You go to Israel, and my father-in-law has a farm in the Jerusalem forest, a house in the Jerusalem forest, and there's a massive great big picture of Rabbi Schneerson on the wall of the farm there. And lots of Jews would think this is ridiculous, and some think he was the Messiah. But that relationship does not break down in the same way that Christianity and Judaism has broken down. Now, that is why is it broken down? It's not broken down because of the questions that you ask, Justin. It's broken down because of power. It's broken down because of the way in which Christianity related itself to power. It's not there are theological differences, but we can all manage differences. We can all manage differences of view. But when historically Christianity has great power and has persecuted Jews for centuries, this is the problem. And this is what creates a double sensitivity, triple sensitivity about what we're doing. So it's not about, you know, when I celebrate the Eucharist, I think, of course I do. I absolutely do. I'm an Orthodox Catholic Christian. So I do think those. But I don't think Jews get terribly offended by that at all. I think what they get offended by is the fact that for centuries, this language has been the language of persecution. And that's what has to be addressed.
So your original question is it a problem if the Christian claims that and I'm using these terms forcefully, that the Old Testament points to Jesus? Well, because it does. The Old Testament directly points to Jesus because the New Testament tells you that it does. You know, Matthew's, this was done to fulfill what was said by the prophets, is continually referring back.
Correct.
Does the Tanakh point to Jesus? The answer is no, it doesn't.
Correct.
So at the risk of self-promotion, my friend Mark Brettler, who's my co-editor for the Jewish Annotated New Testament, and I published a book in October.
Which is, by the way, brilliant, and everybody must get that. It's absolutely fabulous, by the way. Sorry.
I didn't know you read me. That's lovely. called The Bible With and Without Jesus. So if you're a Christian and you say, well, Jesus fulfills all this stuff, the answer is, of course he does, right? And I can show you how it works. But if you say to a Jew, Jesus fulfills all this stuff, the Jew can say, no, he doesn't. And I can take exactly those same passages and show you what else they mean. So our problem is this sense of a zero-sum game, which from a theological perspective suggests that God only plays in one lane and God has no sense for diverse cultures or human imagination. And it also suggests that God's covenant with Israel has been abrogated, which, as far as I can tell from the Bible, didn't happen. Right? And from Christian preaching, didn't happen. So if we could figure out how to stop wrestling over this text, that would be great. And finally, on the tapes of the Pharisees conference, which was May of 2019, the book of all those papers, plus others, is coming out. I'm one of the co-editors. I know this. Is coming out in December. And we got a very nice audience from the Pope, because when you have this big conference in Rome, you can get an audience with the Pope. And the Pope doesn't write the Pope's talks because he's busy being Pope. So you have the conveners of the group that write the talk. So I got to be one of the writers of the Pope's talk, which, according to my husband, made me like a Holy Ghost writer. And in this statement that the Pope read, which is now on the Vatican website, the Pope says, stop using Pharisees as negative examples because it's bad history. And the history of using that image is bad for Jewish Catholic relations. Don't do it. How nice if that message got across. There are other things to say when you hit those passages in the lectionary.
Justin, I've forgotten the person who said this, and AJ will know. But there's a very interesting story that someone once told about this difference. And so the story is that the Messiah comes, and there's a group of Christians and a group of Jews sat round. And the Jews go, this is the first time you've come, isn't it? This is the first time you've come. And the Christians go, this is the second time you've come. This is the second time you've come. And there's a pause. And the Messiah goes, actually, I've come many times before, but you've been too busy arguing with each other to notice. Now, I sort of love that text. It's like, actually, there's more that unites us than divides us, and that's what it says to me. And that's where I stand.
Yeah, such an interesting conversation. Look, let me mention some of AJ's fabulous books as well before we finish up our time, because
I need the royalties. Yeah.
Yeah, the Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus, Short Stories by Jesus, the Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi, and indeed the Jewish Annotated New Testament, which AJ has mentioned, are all available, and I'm sure a part of that library behind you somewhere, Giles, as well. But these are all, if you want to dig further into some of the fascinating stuff AJ has only scratched the surface of when it comes to the Jewishness of Jesus, that will be a great place to start. I mean, very personal question just to end here, AJ, for you. Are you waiting for the Messiah as a Jew yourself, or is that, do you approach that in a different kind of way yourself?
When I am in the synagogue and I am praying a full Hebrew liturgy in a modern Orthodox synagogue, of course I am. And when I'm outside the building, it's not what most occupies my concern. There's an old medieval commentary that says, if you're about to plant a tree and you hear the Messiah is coming, finish planting the tree. I'm going to go with that.
Okay. Giles and AJ, thank you so much for what's been a really fascinating interaction between you both today. I'll make sure there are links to both of you and the books that we've been talking about today. But for now, thank you very much for being my guests on The Big Conversation.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, AJ. Really lovely
thank
to meet you,
Mother. What fun.
What fun indeed it was, wasn't it? Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the show. Do get in touch with your thoughts. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can find me on social media too, at unbelievablejb for the Twitter, to share your thoughts that way and to share the show. facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to look at it on Facebook via the Facebook group. And of course, you can get me on Instagram and TikTok too, justin.briley, if you want to follow. And just a final reminder, we'd love your thoughts on today's show via our survey as well. There's a link from today's show, and if you can fill that in, we'd really value your thoughts. It's just quick and multi-choice, but you can leave comments if you want as well. And of course, you're welcome to sign up while you're there to The Big Conversation show. Here's some of what you were tweeting in response to last week's show. That was John Vivekhi and Sohrab Amari talking about wisdom and the meaning crisis. This was Monica who said, thanks, Sohrab Amari, for giving Chesterton's definition of tradition on Unbelievable. Tradition is democracy extended to our ancestors. Also, Justin, don't worry that John Vivekhi was high octane. Kids can listen to books 5 years above their reading level. So can adults. Steenie Gray said, really enjoyed this discussion on ancient wisdom. I look forward to these two having another meeting. They've only opened the box. I hope you have them on again. Glad you both enjoyed it. It was a pretty deep dive, wasn't it? In many ways. But I'm glad it's had a lot of interest from people who've listened. Mark says, hi Justin, listening to your John Vivekhi and Sohrab Amari podcast, awesome. To paraphrase John Vivekhi, absence of systems that valorize our efforts to move from foolishness to wisdom. Love it. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Due to the guys in the subject line, I'm feeling pulled back to my Methodist roots. And in the subject line, you had people like Tom Holland and Jordan Peterson and others of your email. You say Tom Holland's mention of Jan Hus in Dominion and Melvin Bragg's in our Time episode on John Wycliffe have all fired this up. Interestingly, John Wesley and George Whitfield were Anglican clergymen and got the nickname Methodists. And this leads me to two discussion ideas for you. Were the Methodists the social justice warriors of the 1700s, and did they contribute to a bloodless end of the century for England, unlike France? Interesting historical question there. And secondly, the Reformation behind the scenes, John Wycliffe to Jan Hus to Peter Chelsicky to the Moravians to Count Zinzendorf to John Wesley and George Whitfield. Was the gospel the porky, or any other way you'd like to frame it? I'm going to have to listen to this whole episode again. Thank you, Mark. Lots of interesting questions. I'm glad that it sparked so much thought off the back of that. Scott gets in touch to say this, I was surprised and delighted to see John Vivekhi on Unbelievable in my podcast feed this week. I'm a 29-year-old American lifelong evangelical Christian. The YouTube algorithm led me to Jordan Peterson, which then led to Paul Vanderclay, Jonathan Padgett, and John Vivekhi. After being intrigued by conversations with him, I listened to his whole Meaning Crisis series and wasn't quite sure what to make of it all. I could sense some of that dynamic in this episode's conversation too. John Vivekhi doesn't fit any of the familiar boxes, especially not culture war boxes. There's frankly a huge learning curve just to wrap one's head around not just his big ideas, but his fundamental project. He's an academic and talks in a cognitive science jargon with a lot of context built around it. That's probably a liability of his project at the moment. And I think neither Justin nor Amara nor Sohrab were quite sure how to get a grip on what John stands for, and that was probably inevitable. He's not a new atheist skeptic, a new age guru, or a leftist relativist on religion, and that makes him a little slippery. The Christian wishes he'd just find his solution in ancient Christian wisdom. He can't find his way there yet, and he's convinced he's not alone. He's pursuing some way out of the meaning crisis for those who don't see a way back. So why do I find him a worthwhile teacher? His articulation of the underlying causes of the meaning crisis in Western civilization is incredibly helpful. The reduction within modernity of the real to the material and of epistemology to propositional knowing is something that has so fully colonized Western culture that it's informed many of our fights in and out of the church for centuries. In ways, I imbibed such Cartesian assumptions myself growing up in the bosom of the church. I find John's explanation of the four ways of knowing illuminating, and it's given me a very, very useful language in evangelism, in engaging relationship and transformation, union with Christ, where grappling over creedal propositions is unfruitful. So many apologetics discussions allow the skeptic to dissolve our faith into a set of propositions, but John has helped me not to play that game. Also, John's discussion of agape and the Christian transformation of the Western philosophical tradition is probably the best I've ever heard, and you link me that episode 16 of his series, apparently. Thank you, Scott. Fantastic. Very interesting email. You've obviously really spent some time listening to and engaging with John Vervaeke's thought. You finish off by saying this: effectively engaging young people suffering from the meaning crisis is probably the big evangelism frontier in the West. John is a great informant for thinking outside of our typical boxes. Amari and Justin both acknowledged the importance of the challenge John was articulating to the church in its outreach moving forward into whatever is coming along after modernity. Thank you very much. Pete, you give me a PS as well. You'd like to put in a plug for Paul Vanderclay, having him on Sunday. I found him because for a while he was the only Christian I could find publicly engaging with the Jordan Peterson phenomenon and connecting it to the meaning crisis. Right, well, it's well past time to get Paul Vanderclay on the show. He's been a long, long time listener himself and has written articles for us for Unbelievable. Never, that just hasn't happened to actually come on the show, but I'm sure he will. Let's make it happen, Paul. Anyway, thank you very much for that great feedback. Really enjoyed reading all of that. And I've enjoyed hearing from a variety of people across the course of this last week. Got loads more really interesting shows over the summer for you. Can I give you a little taster of some of the things we've got coming up? We're going to be bringing you, as I've mentioned already, Jackie Hill Perry next week. But we've also got lined up for you a really interesting discussion on a complementarian and egalitarian perspective on biblical womanhood. I'll be joined for that by Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller. Also got William Lane Craig and Joshua Swamidas, who returns again, to talk about Bill's new book, The Quest for the Historical Adam. So that'll be an interesting one. And yes, we've got another really interesting Christian atheist debate lined up as well, in the form of Rationality Rules. Stephen Woodford, who hasn't been on the show for a while, not since I debated him in Oxford, I think, back in 2019. He'll be opposite Simon Edwards, who's got a new book out on the sanity of belief. So lots to look forward to in your podcast, on your radio set. Thank you for being with us on this week's edition of the show. And let me remind you what's coming up next week. Jackie Hill Perry, author of books including Gay Girl, Good God and Holier Than Thou, will be joining me on the show following our live stream Q&A that she joined me for last week. You'll be able to hear it in full on next week's edition of the podcast and radio show. Hope you can come back for it. See you then.